Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and a warm welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insight and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program, unemployment edges higher, new numbers are just out, and they don't make for happy reading. The new Stokvel surge reflecting a deepening trust in community-based saving. A new nurse burnout warning as pressure mounts on the healthcare frontline. And a co-living boom raises tough questions about affordability and housing equity. It's Tuesday, the 13th of May. South Africa's jobless crisis has deepened again. Stats SA's latest quarterly labour force survey shows the official unemployment rate rising to 32.9% in the first quarter of this year. That's up a full percentage point from the end of last year. Now listen to these numbers. Over 291,000 people losing their jobs, 237,000 more joining the ranks of the unemployed. The expanded definition of unemployment, which includes discouraged work seekers, now stands at a staggering 43.1%. So, what is driving this decline in labour market participation? Is policy failing, or is the economy simply not geared to absorb job seekers? I'm joined in that respect now by Professor André Roux, economist at the Stellenbosch Business School. Professor, welcome, and let's start with the basics. In a quarter where over 500,000 people either lost their jobs or exited the labour force, what in your view then is the core economic driver of this labour market contraction?
You're quite right. I mean, these are sobering figures. You know, in the longer term, the figure remains above 30%. That's a worrying thing. You know, it goes up and down by 1 or 2 percentage points every now and again, but it's been above 30% since COVID, and above 25% for the last almost 20 years. So it's a chronically high unemployment rate. This particular number, and as you said, the numbers only just come out, so one is still looking through everything. But seems to me that the biggest job losses were recorded in the trade sector and the construction sector. Now, this could be sort of post-holiday season blues. You know, December, leading up to December, people are happy, spend a lot of money, and then realize by January they've kind of overdone things a bit. So it could be partly because of that. It's also partly because in the really long term, structurally, the fact remains that our economy is not absorbing all the new job seekers every year because, and it sounds awfully cruel, they don't have to. You know, there's this myth that seems to suggest that as long as the economy is growing, we'll create more jobs. It's not that simple. You can grow an economy by producing more goods without employing additional people. You might find that a machine as a more effective, efficient, and even cheaper proposition. So the root cause of unemployment is probably a huge army of job seekers who don't have appropriate skills. I'm not saying no skills, don't have appropriate skills. The kind of skills and education that employers are really looking for. That's the fundamental point. There's so many other factors that add to that. Some seasonal factors maybe in some sectors. But also, labor laws, always very controversial, but we've got to bear in mind that if an employer is not obliged to employ somebody, then, and cannot get into trouble for not doing so, then if there are laws applied that apply when you do employ somebody that may get into trouble, you might want to avoid that possibility. So I'm not saying that labor laws are not called for, but they don't really favor employment.
Professor, let me focus on construction and trade, as you've said, shedding jobs. What do you think the signals then about confidence and investment in our real economy?
Yeah, look, the construction industry seems to be in the doldrums, has been for a long, long time. It's probably, we don't have all the detail, it's probably a reflection of stagnation in big spending and construction, you know, investment spending, as we call it, new factories, buildings, infrastructure, etc. In terms of the other sector of the economy, which is also seemingly not employing people, trade, as I said a bit earlier, that's probably a reflection of post-December blues, spending blues, bearing in mind that interest rates, although easing, have not come down as rapidly as many consumers were probably hoping for at the end of last year, bearing in mind that although inflation is coming down, for many cash-strapped households, the cost of living remains exceptionally high. And bear in mind, and this is probably also filtering through in some ways, the global environment of absolute uncertainty, Donald Trump, Trumponomics, you name it. But I think we also need to focus and never forget this, and taking me back to my earlier comment about inappropriate skills or education, that when we look at unemployment amongst young people, we look at those aged 15 to 24. Now, we're not talking about those who are still at school. They've left school. They're actively seeking a job. That unemployment rate is 62%. For those aged 25 to 34, it is just over 40%. And even more worrying is something known as NEETS. Now, that's one of these acronyms that stands for Not in Employment, Education, or Training. Now, in South Africa, there are, there are 10.3 million people aged 15 to 24. Of those 3.8 million are NEETs. They're not at school, they're not in any training, and they're not working. They are not employed. That is a horrific number, a scary number. So unemployment very clearly is particularly worrisome and bothersome for younger people.
So, Professor, the numbers that you've just outlined really are eye-watering. At what point, in your opinion, does this number then move from a warning sign to a breaking point for social and economic cohesion?
Well, I don't think there's any recipe that says that, but we must be pretty close to that. Having said that, the fact, you know, we've got an exceptionally high unemployment rate, there can be no denying that. But somehow people are making do, which does possibly suggest that the extent and the magnitude of the so-called informal sector is not being fully captured. And it's difficult to prove or disprove this point, but chances are that many people, including young people, are indeed somehow eking out an existence, albeit in a more informal way. Otherwise, we really would be living in a country of absolute violence, misery, hunger, poverty, you name it. And we're not quite there yet. But still, the point remains that going forward, one of the major drivers of job creation here and elsewhere has to be what we call self-employment. It's one of the fastest growing kinds of employment internationally. So part of a long-term solution to unemployment here is to encourage and to really enable and facilitate self-employment, small business entrepreneurship. Otherwise, these things are going to go from bad to worse.
Professor, let me ask you this, and I want to come back to that phrase of appropriate skills, which I think is absolutely relevant. And you've worked with policy and business leaders in the past. The current employment stimulus strategies that we've got, such as the Youth Employment Service, Public Works, incentives for hiring youth, do you think they're working? Mm. And if not, what do you think needs to change in that respect?
Yeah, I'm afraid that, you know, one welcomes anything. I mean, anything helps, but one doesn't get the impression these things are durable. In other words, I don't think they're really instilling in people skills that will stand them in good stead for the next 20 years. It's kind of just a temporary 6-12 month situation. And that's useful. It gives them a bit of work experience, but certainly not sufficient. We need to stop paying lip service to the idea of education, training, appropriate, you name it. We need to take our education system in its totality, bring it kicking and dragging into the 21st century. We need to improve at school level the quality of teachers, the quality of school management. We need more parental involvement. None of these things yield overnight success, of course, but you've got to start somewhere. Then, as I said earlier, we need to foster from a very early age entrepreneurship in young people. And we need to have mentoring programs. We need to teach them how to run a business. It's one thing having a business idea. It's another thing making that business idea work. In terms of labor legislation, far more difficult, far more controversial. But as I was saying a bit earlier, there's no law that obliges you to employ labor, but are laws that govern what you may or may not do when you do employ labor. So one needs to be, I think, a bit more flexible there.
Professor, I'm going to leave it at that point. As you've said, some very sobering data out today. Just to remind our audience again, that expanded definition of unemployment, which includes discouraged work seekers, now at a staggering 43.1%. That's Professor André Roux, economist at the Stellenbosch Business School. Professor, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this isn't really surprising. In tough economic times, South Africans are turning to a time-honored tradition, but with a digital twist. There's new data out from FNB and shows a remarkable 66% surge in Stokvel account deposits, with over 13 billion rand saved by the end of last year. Even more impressive, though, is the digital Stokvel savings have almost doubled in a year. I think that's probably a clear sign that collective saving is not only alive and well, but it's also evolving. So let's explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Gugu Zikali, Head of Client Experience at FNB Cash Investments. Gugu, a very warm welcome. Over 60% that increase. It's pretty impressive. Is it trust, is it tech, or necessity? What's driving it?
We think it's a combination of both, hey. I think that the reason why Stokvels have lasted so many years and have really thrived in our communities is because they work. Their method works. You have people that can hold you accountable to continue to save consistently. So that works. But now, if you couple that with a technology that now enables you to do it more conveniently, introduces people that otherwise would traditionally have thought, Stokvel's not for me. I think it's a combination of those two things.
How do you think the Stokvel model then is changing the game, particularly on the digital front compared to traditional cash-based groups? How is the thinking evolving, do you think?
Where we think the biggest change is probably going to be is that you will suddenly, where Stokvels were traditionally people within the same community in terms of physically safe stationed to next to one another in one form or another. Now, with a digital offering, it means, Jeremy, you could be in Mpumalanga and I could be in Cape Town and we could have a couple of friends around the country and we could start a Stokvel together and transact on a Stokvel in a manner that is continuous and transparent. So that's one, right? Just in terms of proximity, the groups and the communities don't have to be next to each other from a proximity point of view. But also, I guess we're now seeing that younger people are coming into the game. I guess maybe the technology is enabling it as well. And then I think that we also see that probably the more higher income earning groups will also start to see value in being able to have the value, I mean, have the convenience as well as community.
So, Gugu, if proximity is no longer critical or is changing the game, I'm assuming then that you're seeing different kinds of Stokvels that are starting to emerge. I'm thinking, for instance, of investment or business Stokvels beyond the traditional grocery model as we've known it in the past.
That's exactly it, Jeremy. That's exactly it. Where traditionally it would have been, we're saving for December, we're going to get groceries, or maybe it was just burial Stokvels. Now you have people saving together to travel, people saving together to buy into franchises, people saving together for investments, as you put it. So definitely we're seeing a shift
Do you think that digital stockfills can scale to build intergenerational or bigger wealth, or are they still mostly as a used as a short-term safety net?
We think the majority today are still used as a short-term safety net, but I do believe that we are going to see that shift, and maybe at some point it will tip, because one, it is now enabled, and two, people that are, like I said earlier, did not necessarily see themselves as the stockfell people in the past, suddenly will open themselves up to the possibility of having the benefit of higher balances that I, as an individual, may not be able to get to a 50,000 balance in the month one. But if I come together with 50 of my friends, we suddenly have 50,000 rands together, and we can earn interest rates in those brackets. So people will see that. And then I think we'll have a different type of customer, and also just in terms of different aspirations and people looking to create wealth beyond short term.
Do you think this is any way indicative of declining confidence in formal individual banking, given that there is a rise in this community-driven financial approach that we're talking about?
It's hard to say, but I don't have reason to believe that. I think that people will continue to save as individuals, and they will take advantage of whatever vehicles that are available for them as individuals. But I think it's less of a decline in that area and more of identifying a new opportunity.
And just finally then, digital platforms have become central to this whole paradigm, but there might be an issue around accessibility, particularly for people with low tech literacy. How is that being addressed?
That's a very good question, Jeremy, because, I mean, we know that traditionally the people who have been with stockfells and believe in stockfells are the older generation. So in as much as we do see that some older people in our base are taking up apps and using them, we are very cognizant of the fact that there may be some that are not. And, I mean, we have people who have stockfells in the rural areas, and they may not. So I think from our point of view, we see this is that we have more than 600 branches across the country. We have the right infrastructure to service people who feel, listen, I still want to come into the branch and see a warm body and be serviced that way. So we still have that available. But we're also saying that we realize the power that comes with digital stockfells. And we want to make it available to anybody who can access it. Because it's not just available on the app, by the way. It's also available on your USSD. So those small basic phones, I forget what they're called now.
That's fine. And thank you very much for articulating it. It's an interesting look at the way in which stockfills are evolving in South Africa. That's Gugu Zikali, Head of Client Experience at FNB Cash Investments.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this past Sunday, you might or might not know, marked something called International Nurses Day, and possibly a moment to reflect on the lifeblood of our healthcare system, nurses. At the heart of the conversation, though, is the question, is South Africa doing enough to support them? Well, Life Healthcare, one of South Africa's biggest private hospital groups, says not yet, and they're now making it a priority. I want to talk about this with Merle Victor, who is Chief Nurse Officer at the company. Merle, a very warm welcome to you. I think we know what the problems are as far as the nursing profession is concerned. Burnout, understaffing, also mental health issues. Not new problems, of course, but I guess the question is, why have we not moved swiftly enough to fix them?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Yes, it definitely is a real problem. And I think we have been reflecting so much on the staff shortages, but not really what has led to those shortages. And I think it is due time that we really sit back and reflect on what is happening within the nursing profession and what is at this very moment the biggest burning platform. And that is the mental health of our nurses. And I think this year, the theme highlights the direct link between the well-being of our nurses and the strength of healthcare systems in economies. So we face global health challenges, we face workforce shortages and increased mental health issues. And therefore, caring for our nurses has never been more crucial.
So let me ask you this. How does a mental health issue actually impact on a person itself in the workplace, in the hospital, in the theatre?
You know, if you are not of, if your mental well-being is not taken care of, you can imagine coming on duty, feeling stressed, having a sick patient that needs you. Already that impact on how you're going to react towards that patient. And if we want to ensure that our patient get the quality care, the attention that they need, we need to keep our nurses healthy enough to do so.
So how do you go about starting to right-size that problem?
Recognition is the first thing to do. Recognize that there is a definite problem. I don't think that we have given a due respect to the impact of the COVID era on our nurses. You know, it is not just our communities that lost loved ones, but they did as well. And they really sacrificed a lot, putting themselves on the back burner just so that we can take care of our patients during that time. And on top of that, the grappling with the understaffing, rising workloads in the business, that in itself has had a detrimental impact on how our nurses perform. So in Life Healthcare, we have really started investing significantly in promoting our wellness programs through our Life Health Solution partners. We give a lot of mental health support through them, and there's a lot of recognition initiative. We have wellness days that we promote every single month. We give free confidential counseling and resources to address emotional, mental, financial, and legal well-being, not just for our staff, but also for their families.
Why do you think industry-wide, Merle, there is still a gap, though, between recognition, as you point out, and the resources that are needed to try and fix that?
You know, there's a lot that has impacted on resources over the past years. And part of that, firstly, is that, you know, we've got a growing population, increased burden of disease. And on top of that, there's also fiscal constraints. There has been a change in how we train our nurses, so our entire qualification framework has changed, and that in itself has also impacted on the supply of nurses. In turn, however, that has left us with massive shortages. It has left us with our current nurses being burdened with excessive workloads. And unless we get that right, this will can continue for the next, 30 years. Mm. And that needs to be rectified. So we really need to put our heads together, pull out all stops to fast-track training programs, get our facilities accredited so that we can offer training where needed. Our biggest gap at the moment is our specialist nurses, and those are the programs that has been halted in 2019. And we are still 5 years later hoping to be accredited, certainly within our Life Healthcare facilities, so that we can start those programs as from next year. That will alleviate at least quite a bit of the burden that we are currently placing on our nurses.
Let me pick you up on the brain drain issue, which is well documented in South Africa. In other words, nurses heading abroad. Critical, as you rightly say, to keep the talent here. Have we not reached a point, do you think, where government and the private sector should be forming an urgent retention pact, which doesn't seem to exist right now?
Absolutely. You know, you can have retention strategies as much as you want to, but you have to create a positive practice environment for your nurses. So no amount of money will retain somebody in a workplace if they are not happy. And we find that, of course, nurses leave because they get offered better packages, but there's better living conditions. There's less financial strain on them at the end of the day. So I agree that we need to put our heads together and see what we can come up with, because currently what we are finding is that we're almost fighting against each other for a certain pool of resources needed everywhere. I think the plan must be to, first of all, retain what we do have, but then to see how we can increase the supply of nurses. and you know, lessen the burden on our current staff.
Just a final one. I understand that money isn't always the primary motivator, but many that I have spoken to in the nursing professions also complain, both private and public sector, that they are simply not paid enough for the level of demand that is placed on them.
Absolutely. I cannot agree with you more on that. And, you know, I think when we look at any job that's seen as a public service, it seems like the monetary reward doesn't really compare to what you would get if you are, for instance, in IT or in legal, in a legal profession. And I really think there should be a revision on what our nurses are currently earning. And if we really want to retain, we will never be able to compare packages to what is being offered overseas. But we can certainly do much better than what we are currently offering.
Merle Victor, thank you very much indeed. Chief Nurse Officer at Life Healthcare, I do appreciate that insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, from Cape Town to Johannesburg, we're seeing a surge in something called co-living spaces or micro-apartments. They are smaller, they are shared and often marketed as smart living. But I'm wondering if these developments are an exciting sign of urban innovation or maybe just a response to rising costs, falling affordability, and young professionals, many of whom are being priced out of the market. Someone with a view on that is Yael Geffen, who is Chief Executive Officer of Lou Geffen Sotheby's International Realty. I want to discuss what this trend really tells us about the state of the economy and, I guess, our cities as well. And maybe, Yael, the best starting point here, from your definition, what exactly are co-living spaces and micro-apartments? Give me your best definition.
So they are tiny spaces between 20 to maximum 40 squares, micro units, and they are in most of the metropoles. They are developers' dreams at the moment because they are developing like beautiful heritage buildings or underutilized buildings into these tiny little spaces that are trying to promote community living and also have, you know, super high-end fittings and availability to the work nodes, some universities, all of that. So they're tiny. I mean, you can't really swing a cat in them, but they try and zhuzh it up and make it look really good and feel really good. And it is more affordable, obviously, but they try and make them quite zesty by giving them facilities, gyms, coffee shops, those kinds of things.
And do you think this kind of property trend is being driven by choice or, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, by pure financial necessity?
I think it's both. I think innovation is leading to this. We are late in the game for this. This has been happening overseas for a while, but affordability certainly is a help for this trend because right now we know the interest rates are still close to the highest in more than a decade. So I think it's both to answer your question.
And Yael, do you have a sense of the typical person who's choosing to live in this way? What's the current existing demographic?
Definitely students, and there's many student micro apartments around the country, Northern Oaks, and also the millennials, young single people. They just want to get in on the property ladder. This is going to really fill a gap and be a stepping stone to get onto the property ladder. So we're not seeing it yet with families and older demographics, more the younger generation.
Let's talk about that ladder into the property market. Are these spaces genuinely affordable or just smaller for the same price? And I guess, again, it depends on where they're located.
So that's a very good question because Cape Town is an outlier market. So in Cape Town, it's not as affordable as the rest of the country. You'll be getting in higher. It's slightly inflated. But yes, the rest of the country, they are affordable, much more affordable than traditional apartments.
And Yael,
it's a developer's dream right now. Well, honestly, it's still a developer's market.
Let's talk about those developers then. Do you think that they are responding to current demand, or are they starting to shape it?
They are shaping it because they are setting the tone and the scene for how this is all going to roll out. So right now there are more micro apartments than buyers. And so they are setting the tone for that. And for investors, it's a great time to buy now because the resale value is only going to go up.
There are, of course, Yael, risks that come with this co-living concept, particularly, I would imagine, around privacy and also a determination of long-term value, surely.
Yes, so you are definitely on top of each other. Some perhaps not in such a fun way, but it is. It's community living for sure. And right now, our economy has been hit, and it's definitely a response to our economy. But I think we personally think that this is here to stay. This is a trend that's here to stay for sure. Even the banks are getting their heads around financing it. There's regulatory hurdles and zoning laws also getting their heads around it. But we believe it's here to stay. But again, it's according to the market that it is. Right now, it's the young student, the trendy, the millennials, a few of the Gen Zs. But for broader housing reform, we don't know. But I don't think it's going anywhere just yet. It's offering kind of a sexy alternative to getting in on the property ladder.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Yael Geffen, who's Chief Executive Officer of Lou Geffen Sotheby's International Realty. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that also concludes MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are live at midday weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.